Now, this is terrifically exciting. Izzy Tree. Her previous book on this subject, Wilding, was the winner of the Richard Jefferies Society Literature Award, and it tells the absolutely extraordinary story of the creation of the Knepp Wildland, the first large rewilding project in lowland England. She and her husband, Charlie Burrell, have let the grass and the trees and the bushes grow for others to follow. If you haven't been there, you must rush there. It is the future. This time, in conversation with Alex Langland, the eminent historian and architect, she is discussing her new book, A History and Practical Guide to Rewilding, Big and Small. A big round of applause.
Thank you very much, everyone. Isabella, we're delighted to have you here at the festival, and the timing couldn't be better. Not only have we got this fantastic book to talk about, but you've got your new book, The Book of Wilding, A Practical Guide. But we're at a history festival, so I want to kind of turn back the years, roll back the years here. Tell us a little bit about the Knepp Estate and the history of the Knepp Estate.
Well, I think it goes back really to, visibly at least, culturally, you can see it, to King John. There's a wonderful old sort of motte and bailey with the remains of a castle, which was a kind of keep, which was a kind of redoubt for when it used to be navigable all the way up to where we are. Right. You cannot believe it now, because it's just
the River
Ada.
Ada, that's right.
And it's just a trickle, but we've got a huge church with kind of a Knights Templar church with kind of mooring bollards, you know, and you just can't imagine where there's this little trickle of a thing going past it now. But that was, so our sort of estate, it's 3,500 acres, was obviously much bigger in those days. And it was part of the Rape of Bramber, and it was a kind of medieval hunting forest. So obviously not forest in the way that we think of closed canopy forest, but it was imparked, and it had fallow deer and boar, and King John would quite often come and hunt there. So in a funny kind of way, I feel that we're almost closer to those times with our free-roaming Tamworth pigs. And
you are now, aren't you? You are now.
Than all the intervening time when it was kind of being increasingly drained and farmed and everything else.
Well, and I know when we look at the big sort of hunting estates of the medieval period, obviously places like Sherwood come to mind, but the New Forest as well, and King John is always associated with hunting grounds. But they're hunting grounds for a reason, and that's because it's actually quite difficult on those clay soils to grow, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely wretched land to grow food on. I mean, we sit on 320 meters of clay, which is like unfathomable porridge in the summer, in the winter, sorry, if it's a really wet winter, and you cannot get heavy machinery onto it. So modern farming is really difficult. You can't sow spring crops. You have to do all your ditch maintenance, your hedges before the first rains in October. And in the summer, it just, you know, in a dry summer, it can crack. The cracks can be so deep that you can literally put your hand in up to your shoulder.
Right.
So it was always kind of permanent pasture, really, and never kind of cropped in a big way until the Second World War and the Dig for Victory. And then every inch of the land was ploughed up that was available. Water meadows, wildflower meadows, the park, the Repton Park around the house, right up to the front door, you know, in the effort to feed free Britain. But in the 1950s, when rationing was, you know, finally at an end, there were a lot of agronomists, you know, proper thinking people who were saying to government, we've got to stop farming subsidies now because it's going to push us down a route of intensification, divorcing from the realities and the practicalities of the soil, and a sort of addiction to chemical inputs. But we carried on with subsidies. So until my husband took over Knepp, he inherited it from his grandparents in the 1980s. It literally was every inch, available inch, was Was ploughed.
Was under the plough.
Was under the plough, yeah.
And being supported by subsidies, yeah. And therefore in some way sort of enslaved to chemical fertilisers, herbicides,
absolutely.
And
yeah.
so on,
yeah, yeah,
so on
yeah,
and
yeah.
so forth. Give me a sense then of where you'd got to by the 1990s as a sort of farming family and a farming community there on the estate.
Well, when we took over in sort of 85, 86, 87 from his grandparents, Charlie, my husband, farmed in partnership with his grandmother for a couple of years before she died. I think there were five tenant farmers on the estate, and one by one they gave up, mostly very old, some just completely in despair. You know, they just were not making money even with the subsidies. So we took everything else back in hand. Charlie was incredibly optimistic. We were in our early 20s. He'd just finished right. at Agricultural College at Cirencester, full of the kind of green revolution and the, you know, the new technologies and everything he could do to the estate to make it. It was a loss-making farm, and he was going to turn it round.
Right.
And for 17 years, we did everything that a good farmer should do. We diversified, we invested in infrastructure, we tried different varieties of crops, we sold the lovely hobby kind of red pole cows and got proper right. dairy Holsteins and Friesians. You know, we had three of the best dairy herds in the country, so we weren't bad farmers, but the yields were always incredibly low. And as I say, we couldn't sow spring crops quite often. Mm. And looking back, you know, actually, about 70% of our crops went to animal feed because it just wasn't good enough quality for human consumption. So we were actually feeding the, you know, the intensive livestock
industry. And of course,
industry.
in that model, you're losing the calorific content, aren't you, of the crops because you're feeding them to animals and
yeah.
then slaughtering them. So it's not the most environmentally friendly form of farming
anyway, is it? We didn't think of it in those days like that, but
yeah.
we do now.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, that's kind of what happened in the war, though, hadn't it? You know, we needed to grow enough food to feed ourselves rather than our pigs and
yeah.
our cows.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're sort of caught in the crosshairs then of a sort of perfect storm in terms of having just not the right land to compete.
And you know, we were amalgamating dairies, trying to make efficiencies. And, you know, the farm manager, who was a friend, came to us one meeting and said, I've got another way that I think we can make the farm more efficient, and it's going to cost another £250,000. And we were £1.5 million in debt. And we just thought, this is never going to end. And we were thinking that farming subsidies were going to be reformed sooner rather than later. It turned out to be the opposite. But, you know, that was on the horizon. And we just, you know, Charlie, my husband, just said, we've got to call it a day. And so, having made that decision, we were able to sell the dairy herds. I mean, it was a very, very sad day.
Yeah,
and all the farm machinery lined up along the driveway, you know, with everyone coming to buy it, some just coming to look, you know, to witness this sort of, you know, the end of farming at NEP after, you know, hundreds of years. The loss of livestock for the first time. There were no live animals, you know, large animals on the estate. And we sold our the milk quota, luckily at a very high price, just before it fell the following year. The following year was foot and mouth, so we managed to avoid that too. And we cleared our debts. And then suddenly you realise that you're kind of free. You know, if you're in a loss-making business, I hope you've never been in that position, but it is, you know, you're just thinking in terms of the next week, the next month. You're in a complete tunnel. You can't think objectively or imaginatively. You can't stand back and look at your situation. So once that burden was lifted from us, we were no longer farming, we could suddenly think, well, what do we do? And, you know, and then it was like epiphany after epiphany after epiphany.
I mean, it must have been hard for Charlie because we were talking about farming yesterday and we talked about the idea that farming's in the blood. But also that you do have that kind of ancestral pressure, you know, the traditions and the customs of that landscape and doing it. So you've got to be especially strong in some senses to kind of say everything that's been done before, it's almost sort of turning your back to family in a way. So it must have been very difficult for him.
It is very difficult. And, you know, I'm hugely proud of him making that decision, actually, because the pressure from his own family and from you know, not all of the members of his family, and his father was actually very supportive, but from neighbours particularly, we held a meeting about a future wilderness area for local landowners and farmers and family members, because we could see that actually there was countryside stewardship money, so there was a new agri-environment money to actually do what we were about to do. And you know, we thought this is amazing. You could actually do something, you could bring back wildlife on your land, you could restore your soils and be paid for it. You know, who wouldn't want to do this? So Charlie drew up a map which was about 10,000 acres in all, including all, you know, the people, our neighbors around us. And we had all these presentations and brought over some Dutch people who'd been rewilding in Holland to give these talks. And at the end of it, there was just this complete stony silence. We thought people would be cheering and joining in, and absolutely horrified.
Really?
Yeah. So it's only now, I think, that people are beginning to think differently, 20 years on.
Yes. I mean, it's been 20 years, and it does seem to be picking up, doesn't it? Those ideas seem to be picking up. But I'm just going to stay back there 20 years ago. You've mentioned that you'd had some folk over from the Netherlands, and they've been doing some really innovative stuff in what is a much more intensively settled landscape.
Yeah, yeah.
Give us a sense of, just for our audience as much as anything, it's beautifully covered, I have to say, in the first chapter of the practical guide. It's a brilliant essay, actually. The history of rewilding, because that as a concept, you've mentioned the Netherlands, but where did the concept of rewilding come from?
I think the first time it's mentioned as a word, as, you know, a kind of a new word, is in the 1980s. Dave Foreman and some of his colleagues sort of came up with it. And they were really thinking about how to join up wilderness areas in the States. So in those days, rewilding was all about cause, corridors and carnivores. And it was particularly inspired, I think, by, they radio-collared a she-wolf, and she traveled from the Yukon to Yellowstone. I mean, thousands of miles. And they realized that just having these wilderness areas, you know, Yellowstone and Yukon separate, wasn't enough. You know, they needed to create corridors between them. Yeah. So that was really their emphasis. But later, I suppose a decade or so later, what was happening in Europe was really, you know, we kind of hunted to extinction most of our large carnivores, and in very urban, very settled places like the Netherlands and Belgium, well, most of Europe actually, there's this pressure for huge pressure for land, and there's no big wilderness areas without anybody living in them or actually being most of I mean, our national parks are pretty much farmed. You know, it's a completely different concept. And this amazing Dutch ecologist, Frans Vera, came up with a theory that really excited us, because he says that, you know, in all our imaginings of what temperate zone Europe used to look like before human impact, it was closed canopy woodland. Yep. You know, the sort of the myth that a squirrel could have run from John O'Groats to Land's End without touching the ground.
Right.
And there's a lot of kind of very, you know, sort of androcentric, perhaps, sort of myths, you know, about, and perhaps Freudian, a little hint of Freud in there too, about, you know, man coming in, clearing the virgin forest, sowing his seed, you know, kind of creating agriculture, creating a wonderful biodiverse, you know, kind of ecosystem. And what Frans was saying was actually our landscape was already much, much more open than we imagine. Yeah. It was more like the Serengeti, and it was driven by these huge herds of roaming animals that we've just completely forgotten about, because we exterminated them so early in our own history. So it would have been full of herds of tarpan, the original horse, of aurochs, the ancestor of the cow, bison, elk, reindeer, wild boar, beavers by the millions. And all of these animals would have been disturbing the vegetation, opening up areas, keeping them open. Stonehenge is a great example. That was always probably a huge grazing plain full of animals. And the reason we've got Stonehenge there is because it was easy hunting ground, and that was where we could actually see our quarry. And so what Franz is saying is that that's what creates biodiversity. It's the disturbances of all these animals. It's the way they transfer nutrients around the landscape. They move seeds around the landscape. So a cow can carry about 200 different species of seed in its gut and its hooves and its fur.
Yeah.
And that's a huge impact on vegetation movement. It's a very dynamic ecosystem you then have. So what he was saying was, if you want to restore biodiversity, then the way to do that is to introduce, allow vegetation to grow, but then introduce the free-roaming animals to bash it all up.
Yeah.
And that, those messy margins are where life thrives.
Mm.
So we thought, well, we'd love to do something for nature. We've always, Charlie and I, been interested in nature, always traveled the ends of the earth to see it, but never thought we could have it in our own backyard. Could we do something to bring back wildlife on NEP, on our very depleted, kind of chemically soaked soils?
Yeah. So this is, these ideas are there in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Well, after we'd, so actually after, it was just a complete coincidence. I think we hadn't been looking at any alternatives because, as I say, we were just trying to,
Yeah, because I found that really interesting. You sort of, it's like a step into the unknown.
Yeah.
And how conscious of you were you that there were these other ways of managing
landscape? Not at all. Not at all, right. Until we stopped ourselves and looked around, you know, literally sort of put our heads up and, you know, and actually looked around.
But there's a sense of, there's a sense of that in the book. The wonderful thing I like is just stopping and watching. The stopping and watching and learning.
Mm.
And we'll maybe come on to it. You talked about trees. Is the answer just to plant more trees? No.
No.
It's stop and watching.
Yeah.
So you had that sort of period when you're just observing. To what extent did the landscape then inform the way you thought you wanted to rewild the estate?
Well, it wasn't really us. I mean, we were still had very farmer heads on, you know, and we were still kind of control freak, you know. Oh my God, there's a dead tree, we better cut it down. And it was really Ted Green, who's a wonderful ancient tree specialist, and he he's now in his late 80s, but he was working for the Crown Estates, managing those wonderful ancient oaks in Windsor Great Park.
Yep.
And we asked him to come and look at a gigantic tree known as the Nep Oak, that, you know, it's 550 years old, and this amazing creature would have seen, you know, the English Civil War.
It
had seen every sort of new vehicle underneath its boughs, just standing on the edge of the drive, and it was pulling apart. And in the Second World War, when the Canadian Army was stationed at NEP, they tied it together with tank chains, and that was kind of beginning to fail. And so we wanted to ask Ted what to do, and he gave us some very simple advice, and we've put some different sort of structure in to help it. But this is a tree absolutely in the bloom of kind of its middle age. Mm. I mean, it's going to go on for another 500 years. But he looked behind him, and he looked at the sort of 200-year-old, 250-year-old oaks in the park, in the Repton Park, that were just ploughed up to their trunks.
Mm.
And he said, those are the trees that are sick. And we were so shocked because, you know, we'd noticed they'd been going a bit staggy, and we thought, well, maybe it was the hurricane of 87, maybe it's drier summers, you know.
Mm.
We hadn't actually put it down to us, but it was what we were doing to the soil, to all the roots, the mycorrhizal fungi underneath, you know, soaking it in chemicals and herbicides and fungicides. And that was a real eye-opener. We suddenly thought, those trees are dying on our watch because of what we're doing to them.
Yeah. So that was you open the book with the first book with Ted and the story of this oak. So it's clearly a really sort of an epiphany for you. You embark on a project here. What I find really interesting is that we talk about rewilding quite a lot. And I've done things like reenacting. I've done a lot of reconstruction, and we've always been there is a critique out there that I'm not reconstructing an Iron Age roundhouse.
Yeah,
I'm constructing my image of an Iron Age. I thought it was you know, the suggests are going back to something, and we'll definitely get on to baselines and shifting baselines. But you don't use the re suffix in the title of your books, and I think there's a line in there in page 47. I'm at risk here of sounding a bit like an academic squabbling over definitions. you chose not to use the re-element. Was there a reason behind that?
Well, I mean, it was really tongue-in-cheek, and I think now, I mean, when I started writing Wilding, which was, I suppose, 6 or 7 years ago, you know, nobody mentioned rewilding as a word. I mean, it was a really dirty word. It was associated, if anything, it was with kind of releasing wolves into Scotland. And but, you know, it brought up such a kind of fury amongst people. But I think also academics as well found tripped up on that little re suffix, as you say, prefix, because it suggests that what you're trying to do is recreate the past, you know, that we are trying to go back to King John's wonderful, you know, hunting forest. And of course, you can never do that. Yeah. It's not just humans. I mean, humans have obviously completely messed up the planet. But, you know, so we've changed the climate, we've changed water courses, we've polluted, we've hunted many animals to extinction. So we can never go backwards. Mm. But nature anyway is also evolving all the time. It never stands still. So to think that we could even, without humans, go backwards is kind of mad. So I called it Wilding, just to kind of calm the academics down, really. You know, and then the publisher just wanted to call the next book The Book of Wilding. But I think rewilding as a word is just fantastic because it's so difficult to sort of define. It shapes shifts all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, are we over it now?
I think we're over it.
We're over it because...
Some parts of the country aren't over it, but some better than others, yeah.
But I think, you know, like you say, it's been sort of 20 years and things are gathering pace. Do you think that's largely because people are really genuinely waking up to the fact that we are losing species? You've got the turtle dove here on the front of this book. I want to ask you about the turtle doves on the Nepa State. Where are they at? Because turtle doves numbers were in absolute free fall. Yeah. You've got colonies, haven't you, on the Nepa State, but more broadly in the UK, where are they at? Clinging on or?
I mean, they're on their way to extinction, basically. And so when I was a child growing up, not far from here, in the 1960s, we had 250,000 turtle doves in Britain. And now we're down to, we can't even count them, but we're probably down to a few hundred, I mean, in the southeast of England.
Right.
Probably maybe a few more, but and their numbers continue in free fall. Mm. NEP is probably the only place where numbers actually have increased, and we now have a quarter of the population in the whole of Sussex on our little tiny bit of land.
Wow.
So we have, I think, about last count, we had about 20 singing males. So we hope that they're breeding. That could be 40 turtle doves.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's a lovely message of hope and a little glimmer of hope, but it's not going to be the critical mass to save that species from extinction. And I think the RSB reckon there's probably just a few decades left before we lose it altogether. And this is what we sing about at Christmas, you know, what my true love gave to me and, what you know, Chaucer and Shakespeare. It's our culture, and we have lost this bird because we've destroyed its habitat.
And that brings us looking back again to, you know, species that we celebrate in historical source materials. It brings us back to the idea of baselines. And you have this concept. Explain to us the idea, the issue with the shifting baseline.
Well, I think that, and this is really interesting, and I think it is an idea that is really catching the imagination, I think. Shifting baselines was, it was made popular, the idea, by a fisheries expert in America called Daniel Pauly. And there's in the Book of Wilding, that we've put in the photographs that he used to illustrate shifting baseline syndrome. And it's a sort of sport fishing boat. I don't know what you call it, but anyway, you going out from one of the Florida Keys, I think it is, and catching, you know, fish. And in the first photograph, in this, I think it's about the 1940s, there's huge grouper, you know, big kind of pelagic fish that are bigger than the people that caught them, and they're all looking really cheery. And then the next decade, there's slightly smaller, but they're still looking really cheery.
Yeah.
And then the next photograph, there's no pelagic fish at all, no big fish, completely different species, kind of more inshore fish, still really cheery.
Yeah.
And then at the end shot is this tiny string of fish about this big, with equally cheery people catching them. And so every generation thinks that this is normal and that this catch is fantastic. Yeah. They don't realize what, if they do have a glimmer of something changing and of loss, it's probably only from parents or grandparents. Mm. You know, my grandparents saying there were, you know, clouds of skylarks and lapwing and partridges in every field, that kind of thing. But you're not thinking back further than that to the days when, you know, there were herring shoals that would come into across the sea like a tidal wave,
yep.
And they'd be followed by great white sharks, and there'd be tuna leaping in our waters. Yeah. You know, we completely lost all that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the really interesting ways, and you draw attention to this in the book, one of the really interesting indicators of the habitat loss in the English landscape are place names.
Mm.
And Cranbrook, Cranfield, Cranmere, cranes. We used to have cranes on the landscape. I think there were some nesting in Suffolk somewhere or Norfolk somewhere.
They've been reintroduced, I think, in Somerset and doing very well, but they're actually coming back spontaneously into Norfolk. Yep. Yeah,
And another fantastic place name for the locals, Baverstock. Anyone know where that might come from? You've got Beaverbrook as well,
Beverley.
So we've got these fantastic indications of the
lots of wolf's dens.
Yeah,
and wolf dens.
There's actually a wolf's pit mentioned in the 10th century charter up on the hill just here. We were talking about that the other day, actually. Beavers. I wanted to move on to beavers because they're a slightly sort of comedic animal, but I think they're a really fun way to engage with the idea of bringing back, not the megafauna, but fauna that we've lost, animals that we've lost in the landscape. Any reintroduction, there's always cause for anxiety, isn't there, amongst sections of the community? And I think with beavers, you immediately think of trees being felled. We talked about protecting trees, and yet here's a species that fells trees. Blocks rivers, potential flooding, risk to arable land. But actually, they have a profound and amazing impact, don't they, on biodiversity, where they've been allowed to exist and where they've been reintroduced, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, they are a keystone species, and there's probably no other species other than the elephant and us that have such an impact on their environment. Their impact is enormously positive. I mean, hugely positive for biodiversity. There's enormous amount of studies out there. We know that, you know, if you create wetland like the beavers do, you get fantastic, you know, aquatic plants and insects. You get the, you know, I mean, it's kind of obvious. Yeah. But what we're beginning to understand about beavers is that the way they dam is actually protecting farmland from flooding. So it's releasing water, it's holding back water in times of flood, and then it's releasing it very, very slowly, so it's helping to store water. Yeah. We were talking to a farmer the other day who was very against beavers until last summer, when actually he had enough water to irrigate his crops because of this huge beaver dam.
Right.
So in Bavaria, there's... I think I'm right in saying there's 18,000 beavers, and Bavaria, this part of Bavaria, is intensively farmed.
Mm.
And what they have, it is really important to address the concerns of farmers, because of course if you're going to have a beaver, you know, damming a drainage ditch, and it's going to flood your crops, it's really not desirable. Mm. But in Bavaria, they have a fantastic system. It's subsidized by the government, it's run by volunteers, and if you have a beaver problem as a farmer, you call the beaver hotline, and immediately somebody comes around to investigate. 9 times out of 10, you can solve the problem by putting in something, this brilliant thing called a beaver deceiver, which is kind of like a sort of drainage pipe that you put far back from the beaver dam, and you surround it by kind of mesh. So that the water goes into it without making a noise, and without the beaver being able to feel it on their whiskers, because that's what drives them crazy. They'll try and dam it up otherwise.
Right.
And usually you can drop the level of the water using a beaver deceiver. It's used all over the States and all over Europe. But if that beaver is still causing a problem, then you translocate the beaver to somewhere you really do want it, say in upper river catchments, where you're wanting to stop that perennial flooding that we're getting all the time now, and you want to actually improve biodiversity and perhaps include improve water storage too, and water quality. That's the other thing they do. They actually clean the water through this amazing filtration system. But and then, of course, if that doesn't work and the beaver keeps coming back or another one takes its place, then you can kill it.
Yeah.
And that is really important because it's almost like it's too important a creature to protect.
Yeah.
We've got to have that last, you know, that ability to get rid of a problem animal if we have to.
Yeah, I mean, but
and as soon as you say that, yeah, then farmers can relax and they know that,
yeah,
what's happened in Scotland is that farmers have had beavers, you know, the beaver's been protected, and then the beavers are going on to low farmland where they're flooding potato crops, and farmers are worried that they're not going to be able to take, you know, do anything because this beaver is now protected. So they take the law into their own hands even before and shoot the beavers before they've even done anything.
Yeah.
So we can't get to that stage in England when we're finally allowed to have them living in the landscape again.
It's all about management. And you've got beavers. Say a little bit about the beavers you've got on
Brook and
on
Banksy.
What are they called?
Brook and Banksy. Well, they're amazing. So at the moment, you're still not allowed to release beavers in unless they are into an enclosure, but you have to do it under license. So we got license from DEFRA to release a pair of beavers from the Tay in Scotland, actually, where they weren't wanted. And within two months last year, they were introduced in the spring. They had, from a very tiny little stream running down a ditch, created 2 acres of open water. And last year, last summer, that very African summer, you could fly a drone over and it was just like this emerald oasis. And all the birds were feeding there, were drinking there. It's now bleeding out into the landscape, this bright green grass. And it's a haven. I mean, it's a magical, watery
kingdom.
Is this
the one you've got? Is it on page six? You've got that lovely sequence of satellite photos from Google Maps, where in the first photo, it's unbelievable, it's a field of wheat with tram lines cut into it, and then 20 years on, or 15 years on, I think.
Oh, that's without beavers. That's net clay for you holding onto water.
So that's not even the beavers.
That's not even beavers.
Right, okay. I mean, I think the importance of water within our landscape, I was going to talk a little bit about climate change and the impact on that. We're getting deluges and we're getting longer, drier periods. That looks like that's going to be the situation going forward, unless some kind of miracle happens.
It looks like we're not going to make the 1.5 degree temperatures either. It's going to be more like 2.7. So it's going to be much, much worse, climate change.
And so beavers actually have a function in terms of mitigating against climate change.
And I think this is something that we also want to emphasise really with farming, because you know, farming and rewilding have been kind of pitted against each other as kind of, you know, their worst enemies. But actually, you know, we're not asking to rewild the whole of Britain. What we're saying is that actually, you know, we're always going to need wonderful agricultural land, prime agricultural land for farming. But where rewilding can help is by acting as a buffer for rewilding. It can actually provide for agriculture. It can actually provide the life support system to protect farmland from increasing weather events, from droughts, from flooding. It can provide the pollinating insects for crops. It can provide the natural pest control. It can provide the dung beetles. You know, we know that even on organic farms, animals are taken in the winter. And there was an amazing study done a couple of years ago at NEP. What a person surveyed, recorded 500 dung beetles on an organic farm right next to us, and 12,000 dung beetles on NEP in the same day. And the reason for the disparity, the huge numbers of dung beetles at NEP, was because on the organic farm, the livestock are taken in during the winter, and the dung beetles are active all year round. So effectively, you're killing off all your dung beetles. But once those animals are let out in the spring, you know, NEP's dung beetles are just going to hightail it over there. I mean, they're going to swarm over there. So I think that, you know, what happens then is that you can resupply the pollinating insects, the dung beetles, which we know are a keystone species. They save farmers huge amounts of money in the disease control by pulling all the dung back into the soil, but also soil restoration and everything.
I mean, they're a major player in terms of soil stability, aren't they?
Absolutely. So having these sort of network, this webbing of rewilding in terms of corridors, whether that's rewilding rivers, giving rivers more room to ebb and flow, for the floodplains to actually function again, to have corridors, to have growing out hedgerows where species can actually move north with climate change, can meet other populations so that they actually can sustain their genetic diversity. We've got all these little pockets of tiny nature reserves where genetic diversity is just falling because species can't meet other populations. So we've got to have living landscapes again where we've got life holding everything together and physically having these areas of which are going to be buffers and help sustain food production. That is food security in my point.
Yeah, because I wanted to come on. I mean, it's the sort of obvious question, and it's been around since the term rewilding has been in public and popular discourse. I mean, there's a sense we've had it recently with obviously removing ourselves from our main food supplier politically has led to empty shelves in supermarkets, even rationing in some places. Do you think we live in a world that's too binary at the moment in terms of one or the other? Or do you think you're getting that message across that actually rewilding isn't about saying we're taking land away from food and making it wild because we want to see more species and you know all these people that are already struggling with the cost of living crisis and the cost of food? Mm. Do you think we're too binary, or do you think that message is now starting to get through?
I hope it's starting to get through. Charlie, my husband's just been speaking at Groundswell, this wonderful farming conference last week. And that every year the number of farmers going to that conference just swells. It's a festival about regenerative agriculture. Thousands and thousands of farmers are going there now to see how it can be done, and it makes absolute sense. I think we've seen the cost of inputs and fertilizer going up because of the war in Ukraine. Mm. We've seen the damage that artificial inputs does to the land. It's not sustainable. We know we've got about 50 or 60 harvests left in the world before our topsoil is of our agricultural areas is actually gone, and we've got nothing actually left to sow in. Mm. So we've got to think differently. So we've got to think about regenerative agriculture on the one hand and areas for nature on the other that can help support the two. Mm. I think we're going to have to change our ways. I mean, we're going to have to face some difficult questions about the amount of meat we eat. That's clearly unsustainable. Yep. You talked about the amount of area of land put under grain to feed animals. There was a very interesting calculation done by Tim Benton the other day saying that if everyone in Europe, in Western Europe, dropped their meat consumption by 15%, so that's not huge. I mean, that's probably not eating meat for a day or day and a half a week. That would negate any need to import grain from both Ukraine and Russia. Mm. So again, that is food security.
Yeah, yeah. So and the consumer, we all have a role to play in that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm conscious we haven't got long left. There's so much we could talk about. Is it time, I think, to get practical? Let's get practical. It's a practical guide. I've got a reasonably big garden, 80 metres by 15 metres. I'd love to have a mammoth in there. My kids would absolutely love it. Even a pygmy mammoth, I'll take that. Obviously, with the way landscape's broken up, we can't have fauna or grazing animals walking over some parts of the landscape. And I do think this book is absolutely beautifully illustrated. If you've had a long day, you've been tired, staring at a screen all day, flick this book open. There's some wonderful pictures, and pictures tell a thousand words, don't they? You have that beautiful scene where you've got a sort of motorway and a canal and then another road, and it's sort of bucolic farmland. But then what you do in a series of illustrations is demonstrate how you can take that landscape and rewild it. So how can we mimic, if you like, some of these processes that as you've said, the megafauna, the rich biodiversity that comes with those species, how can we as humans mimic them? And should we start with big landscapes and corridors?
I think we've got to do it at every possible level. So the way we see it, rewilding is on a spectrum. So at the wildest end, you've got the wilderness areas like Yellowstone National Park, you know, Chernobyl Exclusion Zone, places where people aren't actually influencing the ecosystem. They don't need to. You've got apex predators. You've got the functioning ecosystem. And then you kind of get smaller and you get to NEP, which is really, on the scale of things, you know, pretty small from that kind of point of view. But you can't, you know, we haven't got apex predators in the UK, nor would they be able to survive in an area of 3,500 acres. You know, I think the territory of a lynx is, you know, about 300 square kilometres. So absolutely no good for apex predators. But we can have free roaming animals doing their disturbance, you know, generating habitat creation. And our main, input, our main intervention is to be the apex predator. We control the numbers so that you don't get huge populations eating out all the habitat. You're kind of keeping a battle between the trees coming up and the vegetation coming up and the animals being able to disturb and create that dynamism. So the smaller you go, the more interventions you need to do. You may get to 100 acres where you couldn't probably have free roaming animals outside all year round. You might be able to bring them in perhaps for a season, take them out again, maybe let it rest for a few years, put in some pigs every now and again, take them out again, much more intervention. And or you start mimicking the impact of those animals. Coppicing, for example, is exactly what our trees and shrubs have learnt to do under the impact of heavy browsing. We're just, when we're coppicing, we're actually being a woolly rhinoceros.
So they're knocking over branches and snapping off the tops and chewing them.
And the vegetation has learnt, co-evolved to be able to spring back into life.
If anything, a hazel shrub will thrive
the more it's cut, exactly. And then you can create ponds and you can, you know, you can act like a beaver. So there's all sorts of things you can do at that scale. And when you get down to your garden, again, often people say, oh, I'm rewilding my garden. And that means that they've just given up doing anything with it at all.
Yeah, that's me.
But, but eventually, if you do that, you know, you'll get trees seeding themselves or a jay coming in and planting some acorns. And eventually you'll have closed canopy woodland over your garden, no light conditions for other flowering plants to grow, and eventually biodiversity will actually completely plummet, and you've got a very static, very pretty boring garden.
So do I get out there and start gnawing at the bark?
You do. It's exactly what you do. So, I mean, you know, it's just having a different mindset. So it's like thinking when you're pruning a rose, you know, you are being the nipping teeth of a pony, you know, or a deer. They've actually done, so what the rose bush is doing is it's kind of responding in panic because it thinks it's going to be the last time it's going to be able to flower because it's being browsed. So it throws out more flowers and it throws out more tannins and more thorns. But they've also found, there's a study that if you anoint your rose bush with animal spit, herbivore spit, so I don't know if you've got a pony or something, you could catch some dribble and put it on the cut bit of the rose bush, that the enzymes in the spit is actually also telling that bush to double the amount of flowers. Right. There's a really good product in there. I keep thinking we ought to devise one day. But again, if you're putting a pond in your garden, that's a wonderful nature-friendly thing to do. It's great fun. It will definitely attract wildlife. But usually it's a kind of ornamental pond. It's sort of circular. Maybe it's stocked with non-native carp or something. Yeah. You've got lawn running right up to the edge of it. But if you think like a beaver, you're going to create a pond that is deep at one end, shallower at the other. It's probably got very messy margins. You might chuck in some dead wood, some branches to kind of make a hiding place for aquatic invertebrates and fish fry. You'll act like a water buffalo. We used to have an Asian water buffalo until we hunted it to extinction. That would have been a keystone species too. Yeah. So you can be a water buffalo puddling around the edge of your pond.
So you sort of,
trash it. Yeah. And that's going to create all these niches where your newts and your frogs can spawn. It's going to create little pockets where aquatic plants can come in on the feet of geese and ducks and things. So it's really just thinking differently and allowing your garden to get messier and more diverse.
Well, it's funny you've said trashing and messy. I wanted to get on, we haven't got long, so I want to throw it open to questions because I'm sure there'll be hundreds of questions out there. It's about aesthetics. this is about aesthetics. To a certain extent, it's about aesthetics. My question here is, what does a tidy lawn now look like? Because to many people, and you know, actually my own family, generations of my family, a lawn should be cut. Because if it's not cut, it's messy.
Yeah.
We have things like areas of outstanding beauty. The idea of beauty and aesthetics has been a big part of the way, certainly in England, we have responded to landscapes since the Romantic period. You know, it's as profound as that, isn't it? We have to rethink what it is to have a beautiful landscape, don't we?
I really think it is. And I think, you know, if you look at a landscape and you really understand how it's functioning or how it's not functioning, and much of our countryside is totally dysfunctional, it's very difficult to consider it beautiful anymore. I mean, my aesthetic has completely changed over 20 years. Mm. It's almost like seeing an oil slick, you know, and actually the way an oil slick kind of, the sheen on it, those amazing colours, you know, in the sun, is beautiful. But I couldn't possibly call it beautiful because I know the damage it does, and I know my part in its existence. So I kind of feel the same about the countryside, and I'm now beginning to feel the same about gardens and lawns as well. I mean, I think it's obviously, you know, as a gardener, you've got to accept your, you know, you've got boundaries of kind of acceptability. You know, you may have children or grandchildren who want a lovely piece of grass to play on. They're going to want to have a flat surface if they're going to want to play ball games. They're not going to want to have thistles in it. That's fine. But, you know, think about the edges where you could have some longer grass and you could, you know, not mow those areas and until late in the summer after they've set seed. Think about the vegetation structure. Think about why are we watering and why are we fertilizing our gardens so much? It's a kind of inherited influence, I think, from agriculture. We want our gardens. We think they're beautiful if they're leafy and productive. But actually, you know, why don't we, and this is what we've done, we've turned, and there's pictures in the book, but we've completely turned our walled garden on its head. It did contain this croquet lawn, which was the sort of pride and joy of Charlie for a bit. But anyway, he's now changed his view. Well, he's had to, really. But so we've now we've dumped 700 tons of crushed brick and concrete onto it from a building site that was on NEP.
Right.
And we've turned it into a sort of 3D a kind of mosaic of habitats. So now you've increased your surface area so you can fit many more plants in.
Right.
We've got a substrate that is very dry, so all the plants going in there are very small xeric plants, you know, dry loving plants. We're not being purist about having just only native plants. We've got plants from the Mediterranean, South America, South Africa, Australia. So we're having great fun with the species diversity. But you've got different plant communities on the north-facing slope, different on the south. Suddenly, that's a really interesting mosaic of habitats for wildlife. But so it does that people do gasp when they see it. And we're having a bit of a run-in at the moment, which is quite fun, with Alan Titchmarsh and Monty Don about what rewilding a garden entails. But they've got to come and see it, because until they have, we can't really have the conversation. But
I'm sure they will change their mind. I mean, you've certainly changed my mind. I've thoroughly enjoyed reading these books. I've been back to wilding since I first bought it, and the practical guide is absolutely fantastic. Can we have a big round of applause for Isabella?
Thank you very much.
We've got 10 minutes for questions, is that right? So we've got some roving mics around. Please put your hand up if you've got a question. We've got a lady down here. Okay, we'll start with that gentleman there, and then we'll come to you.
Right, well, thank you very much. It was a fascinating talk. I'd like to ask a question about, you mentioned subsidies, farming subsidies being the reason for farming post-Second World War becoming more artificial. Why exactly, what was the cause of that in the subsidies itself? Why couldn't subsidised farmland be organic? Why did it get out of control in this way? Thank you.
Well, that's a kind of a big question, and we do describe it in the book. But essentially, I think, you know, what happened was we got caught on a kind of in a sort of mindset through subsidies, whereby We were what the invention of artificial fertilizer did for us was astonishing. It solved the problem of how we are going to feed the planet. But it was a very, very short-term answer. And so I think what happened was we have continued down that track of artificial fertilizers, which farmers were able to afford because they were subsidized, when if we hadn't gone down that route, we would have gone back to rotational systems of farming, such as were going on before the Haber process was discovered. And I think that's now what's happening with regenerative agriculture, is we're going back to systems of complicated crop rotations, but using livestock in the mix. But the secret ingredient, I think, now with the new regenerative agriculture is not ploughing. That's the key answer. But anyway, it's a long answer, but to fully address your question. But it's food and farming is a big question. But much of it is addressed in the book.
We've got a question down here.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk. I was wondering, once you stop putting a herbicide and fungicide right up to those slightly sickly, rather staggy oak trees, do they gradually start to look much better and healthier? Do you see a difference now you've stopped doing that?
I mean, this is just anecdotal, and what am I seeing? and you know, how trees respond is slow. But I think they are. I mean, you know, they have a kind of what Ted Green calls the bloom of broccoli about them. They've got like their canopy has filled out a bit. There's still staggy bits of oaks and bits of branch sticking up, but they've got kind of the foliage is full. We did lose some trees, and one tree was right in our sight line that we just watched. It was kind of on a slope where I think it had just been affected by a lot of runoff of nitrates over the years, and it just, you know, slowly died. And to begin with, we were just itching to get a chainsaw to cut it down because we thought, well, I know we're supposed to be leaving it now, but it's right in our sight line, and you know, it felt completely wrong to be leaving this such an obvious tree dead. And now, you know, we just love it. I mean, it became a thing of great beauty and interest, and sparrowhawks nesting in it, short-tailed voles underneath, and amazing.
Next question, then. We've got a gentleman here, and then we'll go to... Who have we got up next? Okay, this gentleman.
We had Ben Goldsmith talking to us earlier in the week, and he explained that humans were failing as the apex predator for deer, and clearly he's keen to introduce wolves and lynx, and argues that they exist in suburban Amsterdam, so why not in Britain? What do you think about that?
I think, you know, he's absolutely right. I mean, you know, we have, in Germany, they have 100 packs of wolves now, and, you know, they're managing with wolves perfectly well. I've just been to Romania, and it wasn't the wolves that the farmers were worried about there at all. It was bears, but that's a different question. You know, I think Ben has a very good point. You know, why should we be asking people in India to live with tigers and leopards when we can't even live with wolves? We should be sharing this sort of, you know, ecosystem, this planet together, and learning, all of us, how to live with apex predators again. I think introducing wolves into Britain, considering that we haven't even been able to release beavers into the English landscape yet, is going to be a bit of an ask for the next few generations. But I do think, and also I think they would need, it would, you know, more joined up landscapes. But I think very likely is going to be the lynx, because it's a stealth predator. It's terrified of humans. You would hardly ever see it. It needs big woodland, and its main prey is roe deer. So, and we need something to cope with that. So that would be thrilling, I think, to get lynx back in Britain. We are also, at the moment, there are introductions of wildcat again, not just in Scotland, where that population is completely on the decline, but boosting that genetic pool, but also in the West Country. So it would be amazing to have wildcat back. And they might actually help, you know, control the numbers of foxes, keep, you know, get the foxes and badgers stressed a bit, and also keep, you know, territorially keep out feral cats. So, yeah.
We've got a question over here.
Thank you very much. moving forward, it'd be great if we could have a length and breadth of Britain with all this wilding. How's it going moving forward and getting more projects underway and, you know, sort of making a connectivity? Is the government behind it? You know, is there funding available for others to do it and connect these places together?
It's a big question, that. It's certainly, there's a huge will for it to happen. So I think just under private ownership, I think there's probably about 100,000 hectares now under rewilding in England alone. Huge areas of Scotland. You know, Cairngorms Connect is an amazing project connecting all that, those, you know, big areas of regenerating Caledonian forest up in Scotland. Whether the government is behind this, I think, you know, 3 years ago we would have been so much more positive. I think this, the current you know, government is actually pushing back a lot on nature recovery and landscape recovery. We've yet to see what the Environment Land Management Scheme, the new post-Brexit answer to farming subsidies, is going to entail. It will certainly, I think, it is you know, driving in the right direction, certainly making farmers at least think differently about soil and all the, hopefully, the other services that they can apply for, they can stack for funding on top of that. But whether there will be any money for landscape recovery, we will see. Even if worse, I mean, you know, governments always put nature at the bottom of the pile, especially when there's an election coming up. But whether the government does or not, what's really exciting, I think, is the private sector, because suddenly you've got companies that are seriously concerned about their carbon footprint and their impact on the environment. They're being held to account by their shareholders, their customers, their consumers, who can see their accounts now and see what impact they're having. So there is a huge impetus now for putting money into projects that both stack carbon and recover biodiversity. And just very quickly, we have some really exciting news from NEP. I mean, a study that was done, funded, funnily enough, by a government organisation to the tune of about £100,000. So they, with AgriCarbon, they measured the carbon being stored in our soils in the rewilding project. And it's between 3.3 to 4.8 tonnes of CO2 per year, every year since we've been rewilding for 20 years or so. And so what that is, the equivalent to a plantation, a young plantation. So that's a real breakthrough, because what we're being able to show now is that rewilded areas not only provide increased biodiversity, but they also store carbon really significantly. So they can do both. So that, I think, is going to be a game changer.
Great. I know we've got a question at the back there.
Me?
And then we've got what, and then we're going to come to this gentleman.
I just wonder how we could persuade people of this country that grey squirrels are not red squirrels, and grey squirrels do a terrible lot of harm, not only to trees, but to birds' eggs and everything else.
Well, I mean, I'd say bring back the pine martens. And that, you know, that there's studies that have been shown that pine marten reintroductions, both in Wales and in the Forest of Dean, and in areas in Scotland where they haven't actually been completely extinguished, keep those grey squirrels at bay. And so I think bring back the pine martens.
Mm. We've got one last question. This gentleman here.
Hi, Isabella. First of all, I think I could sort out previous lady's squirrel problem. Secondly... are fleas the bane of your life?
Fleas? Oh, flea bane, do you mean? Well, no. And nor is ragwort, and nor are thistles, and nor are docks. But we do have huge areas of flea bane. It's interesting, because we just got to wait and see what happens to it. I mean, nature doesn't like a monoculture, so sooner or later we expect that some pathogen will come in, or some pest, or something that will, you know, lay its eggs on and get rid of the whole, you know, that whole swathe of flea bane. Mm. That's certainly what happens with the ragwort. Comes periodically. It's got a boom and bust cycle like a creeping thistle. That has a huge outbreak at NEP, and that was solved by painted lady butterflies that came over and laid all their eggs on it in a boom year from Morocco. Mm. So No, and interestingly, you know, I think these things find their level. One of the things we've been really intrigued by when we were farming, you know, I would sit in front of the telly and pull ticks out of the dogs, you know, as you do. And we just don't have a tick problem anymore. And we know that, you know, the deer that we are culling, you know, we see the carcass, they just don't have ticks. So what's happening, what's eating those ticks in the life cycle? If we could find that, you know, we could actually perhaps help areas where they do have a problem with Lyme's disease and perhaps, you know, do something to improve the ecosystems there. But no, it's interesting.
Great. Well, look, Isabella, it's been absolutely amazing to get you here down to the festival. I can't recommend these books more highly. Can we have a big round of applause for Isabella? Thanks ever so much.